It's a matter of time, I suppose.
Welcome back to Watchmen Minute, where we're investigating the director's cut of Zack Snyder's Watchmen 1 minute at a time. My name is Travis Bowe from the Real Comic Heroes podcast.
I'm Eric Nash.
And I'm Chad Burdett with the Comics Multiverse blog from the Times Union.
Welcome back, Chad.
Thanks.
Minute 67 starts with Janet Black asking John about Annihilation and ends with Doug Roth beginning to question John. Or I guess asking John about Extinction, not Annihilation.
Yes, we finally learn what she was alluding to at the beginning of her question last minute.
Yeah. So I was sort of right, because, you know, bees are facing extinction, so I'm still maintaining that that's what she's asking about.
And they also fit the yellow and black scheme of the movie.
Nice. I like where your head's at, Chad. So we learn that apparently the Doomsday Clock has been moved up from 5 to 4 minutes to midnight. I wish we still had 4 minutes to midnight in our real world.
Yeah, you're familiar, Chad, with the real Doomsday Clock and
yep,
roughly how close we are to midnight on it in our real world. It's yep. A little scary.
This minute, kind of, we get overall like ominous sounds. It's not really sound effects, and it's not really music. So I guess it just falls into sound design. Like either way, it's sort of ever present when Dr. Manhattan kind of, you know, whenever we're looking at him, like there's just sort of a tone that seems to follow him around. And it's just, it's like ever present. Like I said, just it never really builds, never really subsides. It just kind of hangs in the air, making this scene in a TV studio really uncomfortable.
And John kind of just looks, he's blank.
Yeah.
Of course, I don't, again, the whole emotion thing, you know, not trying, I guess, you know, divorcing himself from humanity.
Yeah. But I like that he doesn't, I mean, he finds a way to respond to her question in a way that uses like a real world example from his past, you know, about his father being a watchmaker. I don't know if you guys have anything on that, but I love this response. So it's kind of like a mic drop in a way, you know. It has like at first it seems like it has nothing to do with anything in relation to what she's asking about. But then he kind of brings it back to, you know, the point about it being a symbolic clock, you know, is pretty pointless. So
the only thing I really have about his father being a watchmaker is what they, you know, mentioned in the before Watchmen stuff, but since that's not, you know, canon right now.
It's still worth it to talk about, though, you know.
Oh, yeah, if you've got...
From what I remember from the Dr. Manhattan before Watchmen was, originally, John wanted to be a watchmaker, but once the bomb went off, his father told him that watchmaking was no longer, you know, important or whatever, and that science was now the thing.
Yeah.
And that's why, even though he was a scientist, he still, you know, tinkered with watches, and why, you know, he had to go back, and how he became Manhattan is, you know, he was going back for the watch. I mean, again, it's been a while since I've read the Before Watchmen also, so it's, I'm just trying to remember what I can.
He even ties into that in just the regular, you know, the actual Watchmen book. He talks about, it's actually the chapter called Watchmaker, and he talks about the, you know, tinkering with the watches, and his father comes in and basically grabs all the watch pieces and just chucks them out the window.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of what we'll get next week with John on Mars, you know, there's a lot of cutting back in the book. There's a lot of cutting back to, you know, the pieces of the watch kind of rain down out the window as, like, you know, the meteors fall on Mars, that kind of thing. A lot of kind of back and forth with that. So I tried to look up Einstein's, you know, theory of relativity here, which, I mean, I know we all understand, so there's really no point in even talking about it because we all understand completely what Einstein was talking about there. So no, I tried to look up like a simple explanation because, you know, it's worth, you know, talking about since John brings it up here, but I could not wrap my head around it. So if either of you guys are, experts on Einstein or, you know, physics or theory of relativity, I invite you to talk about it here, but
certainly not expert. I've certainly read a fair amount, but yeah, that doesn't get me much closer than you have recently, apparently.
Yeah.
I do have, remembered, I don't know if you remember the 1999 movie Deep Blue Sea. But
shark movie?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
But one of the characters goes, Einstein's theory of relativity, grab a hold of a hot pan. Seconds can seem like an hour. Put your hands on a hot woman, an hour can seem like a second. It's all relative.
Huh.
That just somehow clicked.
Yeah.
Just now.
And now that helps me understand it even a little bit more. So thank you for that.
Real life examples.
What's that?
I said real life examples.
Well, my biggest question is, you know, okay, so we're talking about nuclear war and then this comparison to watches and the idea of, well, because time is relative, does that then mean no one is going to want to have watches anymore? You know, I mean, that's why he's not going to be a watchmaker, because time is relative and therefore no one's going to want to have watches. That's why.
Yeah, I think
that's a really good reason to give up watchmaking.
I think so, but I think his father takes it as time and watches and timekeeping doesn't matter. You know,
because it doesn't matter,
right?
The world is such a drastically different place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and science is the new
right. Thing. Yeah, science can prove that time isn't really measurable, then what purpose does a watch have? I guess is how I've always interpreted John's father for making that like drastic push. You know, for John to pursue science instead of watches. You know.
So it's all for show.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah. I love Janet's response to all this. Like, you know, just so you're saying there's no danger, like, and then obviously his response with the world without nuclear weapons, there would still be danger. Is nice that we get the line about danger being followed up with the knife cam kind of going towards Dan. I find that, you know, pretty intentional, but it's the shot itself feels a little gimmicky, kind of like earlier when we had Dan's arm when he's kind of playing with the action figures in Adrian's office. Yeah. I think a shot of Dan with a knife, like if the image was, you know, focused on Dan and then out of the off screen, like a knife came into frame right at Dan, like, and then we get to see him kind of dodge out of the way. That might have been, for me, maybe a little bit more effective. But I get that they're going for, you know, dynamic visuals and trying to make it just more visually interesting. So I can see why they did it. But
and then the next very visually interesting thing, the breaking of the arm at the elbow-ish area, yeah. I think there.
Oh yeah.
Coming out right towards us at the camera. Beautiful.
It's oddly methodical.
Yeah.
Like, just with the precision that that Dan takes, like, because he kind of does it, like, it's not a fast movement really. He twists the guy's arm out and then
just kind of holds him there for a second.
Yeah, it's very precise yet savage.
It's like he's, you know, trying to figure out exactly where he wants to, you know, hit for the most gruesome damage.
Yeah. It's so, you know, visceral, and the way they, you know, do the visual effect, I think it works pretty well. I think it's a little obvious that the guy has like a fake arm sticking out, and you can tell like he's got his real arm kind of under his shirt, you know. But for this type of just practical effect, I don't know of another way you could do it really, without using like a lot of like his arm wrapped in, you know, green, you know, CG kind of stuff to paint it out later. But
that guy's going to need a Band-Aid.
Yeah. He's not the only one, because then we've got, let's see.
The other guy takes a foot to the face from Lori. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a whole lot of mayhem going on in this one. Let's see. Then we cut back to the TV studio where we've got, his name's Paul Klein. The character's name is Paul Klein, asking if, or pointing out, I guess, that so many claim that Manhattan is a god, and given that he sees the past and future simultaneously. So, or I guess he's actually is asking if he would say that he's a god. So, anything, you guys got anything on that?
What he's actually saying, I mean, you know, that he's a god and his view of time, I mean, that's all back to, let's see if Trad knows about it, the Tralfamadorians from Slaughterhouse-5. You ever read or seen?
Oh, it's been a while since I've read.
Yeah. So those are the beings that that are much more, even more non-human than John is, in a very physical sense, though.
I think that the reporter also assumes that he can see into the past and future. And John replies that he can only see his past.
It's a great line that this actor gets to, you know, gets. It's Michael Copsa playing Paul Klein. He's got a ton of acting credits as well. It's like 198 acting credits. A ton of voice acting, especially in like anime. Like he does anime or English dubs of you know, anime stuff like, I guess, Mobile Suit Gundam and Dragon Ball Z, and then tons and tons of TV. But I definitely, it'd be a hard question, you know, the whole being faced with the question of being a god.
It seems that Manhattan's not ready to call himself a god.
Sure.
Even though that's how people see him.
We find out that he can only see his own past. And his own future.
I thought he could only see his future up to the point of the explosion, because it was hazy after that, or the event.
Right. Yeah, and I think he's probably speaking about his, you know, his ability, relatively, like.
Well, I think he doesn't want to. He doesn't want to alarm everyone.
Yeah, that's true. Know? Yeah,
like he does to Laura.
Yeah,
Lori.
Yeah, it would be probably irresponsible to tell them, well, I can't really see my future anymore because of sudden burst of tachyons caused by nuclear war. Yeah, I think he's just meaning like, you know, typically he can only see his own past and future. So it kind of cuts back to the alley fight. Where this is a moment where the fight kind of always stands out to me, and it really takes me out of the hyper reality that I think about this movie. Because typically, you know, the moves and everything that they're performing on these people, they're near superhuman, you know, levels of strength and ability and this fighting technique and everything. Except for like this moment where she punches this dude in the gut and then he flies backwards and his legs get pulled out from under him. Like the physics of the movement don't make sense. The way they, you know, the practical stunt, I think, really stands out. I think it's kind of a poor example of doing this stunt, you know, practically. Yeah, like I said, the physics don't really match up with the action being performed. Did that stand out to you guys?
Oh, yeah, sure did.
Well, after the breaking of the arm, I was kind of, you know,
yeah,
a little traumatized. And but yeah, I agree. Maybe if they actually had some sort of powers, just then, rather than being able to fight really well.
Yeah. And these are, you know, people who have basically been in retirement for like 8 years. So the fact that they still have these abilities, you know, at like near peak performance level is, you know, a little hard to believe, but that's kind of, you know, like I mentioned, we were in this hyper realistic world. Cause I could buy that Lori would stay, you know, maybe she practices regularly. Like she's got plenty of time, you know, on her hands, and maybe she, you know, does some kind of training or physical fitness and stuff like that. But Dan doesn't strike me as the type, especially book Dan, yeah, doesn't strike me as the type that maintains his fitness. But I guess it's like, it just comes back to you, maybe like, that old muscle memory.
Well, for Dan, we even have the third-hand observations by Rorschach of being flabby.
Yeah.
Right.
It's like, well, is he flabby or not? Can he throw these people around so easily? Or, I mean, maybe that he could still win, but just have a bit harder time and not break a guy's arm so easily.
He'd be breathing a little harder.
Yeah.
It doesn't even look like he cuts a sweat here. And I agree that Lori probably would be more apt to. Of course, she also smokes.
That's true. So. I don't know if we see her smoking at all in the movie, or anybody for that matter. I guess Malak has a cigarette lit up later, yeah, but.
And the cigar. Comedian's cigar.
Oh, yeah. Of course.
I just know from early on in the book, every time when she's like hanging out with Manhattan, she has that weird smoking pipe.
Yeah. Let's see. Anything else on any of the alley action before we kind of wrap up with John saying that he's not omniscient.
Oh, the one guy who Lori like repeatedly punches in the face looks like he's enjoying it.
Oh. yeah. I could see kind of with the face that he's making. Yeah. I was looking up the just the word omniscient got me wondering. So I just look up the definition, you know, which is simply knowing everything. And there's this example with the definition which stated the story is told by an omniscient narrator. Which really got me thinking about John himself, and like he's sort of able to narrate his own life as it's happening, because, you know, the narrator in a lot of cases knows what's going to happen to the character, and you know, as he's telling us the tale, whereas like we live in the moment, you know, we don't like see our lives as a story, you know, and are able to, you know, get like a bird's eye view of it the way John here is. And, you know, he lives in these multiple timelines. So even though he says he's not omniscient, he is able to tell his story kind of as it's happening. So I don't know that I agree with him by saying he's not omniscient, but any thoughts on that?
I think the more I have to say about that would be for the next one.
Oh, okay. Cool. All right. It sounds like we're probably wrapped up on this one then.
Yeah. I mean, the only other last thing is it does cut back, though, to we hear Ted Koppel going to bring it up Doug Roth for him to ask his question, and we don't get to hear it, though.
Right.
He just says, speaking of your past, Dr. Manhattan.
Cliffhanger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I suppose everyone can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Watchmen Minute and visit our webpage over at realpodcastnetwork.com/Watchmen Minute.
And you can like our Facebook page at facebook.com/Watchmen Minute and join us in our group, where we can discuss things about broken arms and so forth. The Crime Busters Listener Society.
Chad, where can everyone find you again?
Times Union. Sorry, blog Times Union Comic Books, and then on Twitter I have I'm at TU Comics, and then if you search the Comics Multiverse on Facebook. I have a page there.
Very cool.
Well, I also have an Instagram, which I sometimes use when I'm out at like cons or something. It's TU Comics Multiverse.
Awesome. All right, then. We will be back on Wednesday for Minute 68. Until then, who watches The Watchmen?
We do.
We do.
Watchmen are over.